What's good, everybody? This episode of the podcast is sponsored by DistroKid. They are the go-to for digital music distribution and the easiest way for musicians to get your music onto Spotify, iTunes, Amazon, TikTok, YouTube, and more. They offer unlimited uploads, and artists keep 100% of their earnings in stores 10 to 20 times faster than any other distributor. Fastest payouts. They help out with automatic splits, cover song clearance, and all kinds of other amazing tools and templates to help you get the most visibility for your releases. I dig this company and appreciate their business model that offers more features than any other distributor at the most affordable price possible for solo musicians, bands, DJs, studio artists, and any other creators that are producing music in their home, and they also offer label services as well. They've got three different tiers to offer creators that start as low as $22.99 a year. That's just $1.92 a month, and even their top tier is just $7.50 per month. And the best part about DistroKid sponsoring the podcast is that they are offering Dan Cable Presents listeners and viewers 30% off your first year membership with DistroKid, making their already affordable prices even cheaper for you. Check out the link in the episode notes. I will also put it in my Instagram bio in the link tree. That link will give you 30% off that first year of service. Super stoked to have DistroKid sponsoring the podcast and cannot thank them enough for their longtime support of this thing. This episode of the podcast is also sponsored by Puff Coffee. Puff is one of my favorite coffee shops in Portland, Oregon. They've got a location off 28th and Stark in Southeast. Their coffee is delicious, and everyone that works there is always super friendly. I had the pleasure of staying in their neighborhood for a month or so, and it was just a real treat to have this as my neighborhood coffee shop for a bit. And now I find myself going out of my way to get over there and get some coffee. Puff Coffee was started by the founder of Stumptown Coffee, and they are making small batch coffee roasted daily here in Portland. Their mission: to find, roast, and deliver the most delicious coffees anywhere. Their small batch process means that they get to keep things interesting with experimental blends and single origin gems while always keeping the classics on deck. They've got a variety of beans to choose from, and if you're not in the Portland area, you can order their small batch coffee straight to your home through their website, and you can use the coupon code DANCABLE, all one word, for 20% off a coffee subscription. Links for Puff Coffee will be in the episode notes. Big thanks to Puff for supporting the show and for their amazing small batch coffee. Now let's get into the episode.
Look down at the recording of some moment as I was down to say.
Okay, we'll pull him down.
What is happening, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of the Dan Cable Presents podcast. Thank you for tuning into the program once again. If this is your first time listening, thanks for checking out the show. You can find fresh episodes coming at you every Tuesday. And if you want to help support this thing in a free way, you can do so by clicking subscribe on iTunes, clicking write a review, giving the podcast 5 stars if you feel like it is deserving of so. And that will help propel this thing into the tops of those iTunes charts, giving it more visibility on the national and international levels, helping strangers find the podcast, and just a great way to contribute to the growth and sustainability of this thing. If you're not listening on Apple, just hit like, follow, subscribe wherever you are listening from. Maybe you're watching on YouTube, hit subscribe there so you know when the new episodes pop up. Maybe you're listening on Spotify, you can give it 5 stars and tell a friend about the podcast if you're digging it, and check out the monthly playlists that I've been dropping every first of the month. Those are available on Spotify, and 40 tracks every first of the month, pretty spread out genre-wise, just a snapshot of what I'm listening to throughout the month, and the links for those will be in the episode notes. Stoked to get into episode 402. Zach Bowman, aka Tacit, music producer and composer based here in Portland, Oregon, is on the show this week. And as you will hear, my exposure to Tacit's music was at a Thirsty City event here in Portland, Oregon. And Tacit was performing on a bill with my buddy Slurgeon, who is a former guest of the podcast. It was his album release that night. And Thirsty City is this really cool monthly music showcase that happens every last Wednesday over at the Good Foot, just right across the street from the coffee sponsor for the podcast, Puff Coffee, Good Foot Lounge, right across the street. And Thirsty City is curated by Slurgeon and also other former guests of the podcast, Northern Draw. Love both of those dudes. But when I saw Tacit set that night, it was something that stuck with me. And I just pretty quickly after that reached out to Zach about doing the podcast. And Zach recently put out this really killer record called It Comes in Waves. And we talk about the record and creating the music for that throughout this episode. Just really stoked on the chat that Zach and I had. This one got deep into the creative process and mindset, definitely got a little heady and spiritual at times, which I absolutely loved. It was my first time hanging with Zach, so this was a cool way to get to know them. And just a beautiful record, that Tacit record, It Comes in Waves. Can't recommend people checking that out enough. It's the debut from Tacit. There's a previous EP you can check out as well, and a couple other singles. But yeah, just a beautiful record, and really explores a lot of different genres within electronic music, and a very cool journey front to back. And I loved getting to talk about this record with Zach. And the links for the record will be in the episode notes. And similar to the It Comes in Waves record, I feel like this chat with Zach explored a lot of different things in a short amount of time. And I like the places that it went, and I hope you do too. Stoked to share it with you. Big thanks to Zach for doing the podcast. And all the links for Tacit will be in the episode notes, along with the link for the It Comes in Waves record. You can find it wherever you stream music. And if you dig this thing, give Tacit a follow. And we're going to kick off the episode 402 with one of my favorite tracks from the It Comes in Waves record. It is called Hold On a Minute. Let's do the damn thing.
Yeah, you can say whatever you want to say. There's no...
I don't have to censor myself.
You don't have to censor yourself.
I was here. A little bit worried. I was like, I don't think I have to. I think I watched some of the clips and I saw people
He said fuck. I can say whatever I want.
I'll try and do a decent job just for my parents. They're big podcast people. And
are
I
they?
Told them. I was like, yeah, I'm going to be on a little podcast.
All right.
Like, oh my God. Send it. So yeah.
Shout out to your parents, Zach.
Shout out Virgil and Colleen.
Virgil and Colleen. Uh-huh. I'm very stoked to have Zach here today. For real, man. I'm excited to talk with you. I knew nothing about your music until I went to that Thirsty City night. It was Slurgeon's album release, and you played a set that night, and I was just so into it, and you just looked like you were having so much fun that I love watching somebody perform music, whatever it is. I mean, maybe a sad singer songwriter doesn't always have the opportunity to look like they're having like tons of fun, but I just love watching somebody that looks like they're having the most fun in the room. And I just feel like it's probably even more important on the style of music that you're performing, and maybe like within DJ culture, to if the person at the helm looks like they're super into it, it just makes everybody else want to dance as well. So I was just immediately following your shit, like, after, sorry Virgil and Colleen, I'm already here.
They're okay with that. They're gonna be okay with it.
No, it's I was just like immediately in and just started following what you were doing after that, and shortly after It Comes in Waves came out, like maybe a couple weeks after that. So yep. I was just like, cool, now there's music to check out. And yeah, just a fan of what you're doing, Zach.
Well, thank you so much. Like I said a little bit ago, that that Thirsty City show was the first time that I tried to do a live set, and it was because Michael Slurgeon, we were talking about the show, and he was like, yeah, I'm gonna pull out some of my stuff and do my first live set in a while. And I was like, man, what if I try and do that? And I was like, okay, well, like, I know what a live Ableton set looks like and stuff like that. And so I started like breaking it down. previously, I've never really had enough original non-remix kind of music to do a live set, but I was like, I'm literally releasing an album, plus I've got some unreleased stuff that like I've been working on for post album, and I was like, started breaking it down, and I was like, oh, I can totally do this. Like, I can play a live set. And it ended up like, you know, practicing for hours and hours. And honestly, before that show, I did not get through that 35-minute set without fucking it up at least once. And that show, I managed to actually do exactly what I was trying to do without a, like, one of the errors that I made when I was like practicing. And so like I was having that much fun during it, and all my like little reactions to one, the people in the crowd, like, you know, I'm feeding off of that energy 100%. But I was like, yes, I didn't fuck it up. Yes, let's go.
It's working.
Yeah. And awesome. Yeah, that's just like one of the things is like, I love creating music. That's, you know, why I do this. But like, as far as playing shows, so I've been like playing like little, you know, friends' house parties and stuff like that, starting when I first started producing music when I was like 19.
Okay.
I'd like take my little like launch pad and just trigger other people's songs and call it DJing, which, you know, to a degree, yeah, it works. I wasn't beat matching or doing anything. But then, you know, like just playing more and more, I finally invested in a little bit of like some, not CDJs, but like a controller and record box, and learned how to like properly beat match a little bit. And then in probably like 2018, that seems right, I got to open up for Brass Tracks, who are like this dope, formerly a duo, now it's like helmed by this guy named Ivan. Shout out Ivan if you watch this, you're an absolute inspiration. They're like started as kind of like a doing brass like trumpet remix covers of hits, and then they just like blew up off of that and started doing a ton of good original music. And I just like started following them from the beginning on like the earlier SoundCloud days ish, like 2014, something like that. And so I kind of like developed a personal relationship with Ivan, who kind of mentored me in a couple ways. Okay. And they announced they were doing a tour and coming to Portland for the first time. So I just kind of like shot my shot, and I was like, yo, do you guys have like an opener for Portland? And they were like, no, I think we're, you know, just going to look for some local talent. And I was like, what if I was your local talent? And so he was like, oh, hell yeah, you want to do that? And so I got to open up for them. And that was the, like, I mean, still to this day, one of the best experiences of my life. And it got me this high that I had never, ever felt before, like, on stage, just like soaking in this energy from the crowd, which, you know, like 10 of my friends came, but they ended up selling out the show, and it was one of the most packed, like, Holocene, and I'm there all the time now. It was so packed 20 minutes into my set, and I'm like the first of two openers, and I was like nervous as hell, but like just high off of this intense, like, oh my god, like I got the, you know, this audience here, and I'm like feeding off of their energy. And it was absolutely at that time that I was like, I have no other option but to chase this feeling for probably the rest of my life.
Just kind of this undeniable thing that you couldn't shake. You're just like, I gotta figure out how to,
it was like, okay, I gotta do it again. Like, I gotta find whatever it takes to get the next hit of that. And even one of the scariest things you can do while you're DJing is train wreck, whatever it means, some sort of way. Like, I did the absolute worst thing, and I cut the music entirely on accident.
So brutal.
I opened up a new song, and the song that was already playing just cut.
I've done it, Zach.
My heart just dropped so bad. And then, like, a couple of my friends, like, started cheering a little bit, and they got the entire crowd to start cheering, and I'm like frozen in the moment, and I start crying a little bit. I'm like, holy shit. And then like, yeah, just like the reassurance that I felt there, I was like, oh my God, yeah, this is it. This is what I want to do.
Yeah, making a mistake as a in a DJ set like that is such a drastic thing, I feel
yeah.
like. You know, when you just like cut the music out, I feel like often feel like a fraud calling myself like any sort of DJ, but I do have a controller and I do some sets from time to time. But then when I see someone like yourself perform, I'm like, oh, that's like that's somebody really doing the thing. But I have had that moment where you load the track on the wrong side and you're just like, well, that was the track that was playing, and you just cut it off in the middle of it before you even got to the part that you really wanted to share.
Yep. And before you got to that part that you were planning on transitioning into the next song, it's over now. Moving on.
Regroup. So before that set that you did, had you had much experience playing, like doing live performances,
like the Thirsty City one?
For that opening set that you got to do?
No, it was like, I guess like a couple. The biggest that I had done would be like this. So I moved up from Eugene.
Okay.
In, I think this September will be 5 years that I've lived in Portland. I've been coming up since I was a kid.
Okay. Did you grow up in Eugene?
Yeah.
Okay.
And all I was really doing before that was like either friends' house parties or like little dance club called Cowfish down in Eugene.
Okay.
Which I did like every other Thursday for a summer or something like that. But it would be like 5 to maybe 50 people on a really good night. And so like probably average of like 12 of my friends are here. That's cool. And that was pretty much the experience that I had like actually like DJing in a venue.
Pretty casual.
Very casual. And so to move from that to like a packed Holocene, which was, I think they said it was like 250 so people there, it felt drastic.
Yeah, and you can feel that energy of the people in the room, like you're saying, and it was like already packed out from kind of the jump.
Totally. No, like doors happen and people like flooded in. And I think that I have decent DJing skills and like good song selection. I think I have great song selection. I gotta say, I love myself. But I honestly think my strongest tool as a DJ that like I rely on more than anything is being able to feed off of energy and kind of respond to it, not just like kind of absorb it, but to like respond, send it back, and kind of like read the room. I think that it's like something about, you know, I think I'm an empath or an empathetic person or whatever you want to like call it. But I think that actually makes me really sensitive to like understanding how to work a crowd or something like that. And I had never experienced that kind of energy being focused on me at that level, at like that many people. And so that night performing that, it was like this, you know, I'd get that feeling performing for 20 of my friends or something like that, where I'd be like, oh, sweet. Like, I know exactly what to do. But scaling that up to, you know, times 10 was like, holy shit, I really know what to do now.
Yeah, it gave you like some of that little more confidence.
Yeah,
in that,
absolutely.
In that you were on the right path and that you could handle a big crowd and follow your intuition and read the room like you're talking about.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. So were you, I know you said you weren't really making music till you were 19.
I started like producing stuff really by accident. When I graduated high school, I had very little plan of like what I wanted to do. But I thought I was going to do some like, I thought I was going to either go into counseling or something like that. So I went to Lane Community College, and I was really lazy with signing up for classes. So all of the like intro psych classes got filled up, and I was like, all right, whatever. I'll take some prereqs in the meantime and like electives and do my thing. And I started at their MIDI technology course, because I was like, oh, cool. Like, I've kind of always wanted to be able to, like, make beats or something like that. And I so instantly, like, fell in love with that. I did, like, the whole year of doing that and then, like, an independent study over the summer. And I, like, decided by the end of that that I was like, this is it. This is like, oh, my God, I found it. What I really want to do. And I decided to just, like, not even go back because I was like, I've been doing this at home.
Yeah.
Like, for the independent study or whatever, I'm like, okay, I can learn this at home. Probably say, like, luckily I didn't have to pay for my first year of college because I got some, like, scholarships and grants. And I was just like, okay, sweet. I had, like, had enough leftover scholarship money after tuition to, like, buy my little launch pad and, like, a shitty keyboard. And I was like, okay, I'm going to do this at home. Pre any of that, I got to give a huge shout out to my parents one more time because I have three siblings and they gave us all like piano classes.
Okay.
Like they put us all through at least 1 year and they're like, I really like don't even know what kind of appreciation I would have for music or like just learning it at such a young age gave me like, I guess the head start that I needed.
Yeah, it just always seems like people that learn piano always have this like pretty solid foundation for launching into other instruments or even learning software.
Yeah.
You know, it's like so rhythmic based even and melodic.
It's like the basic format that you teach everything else on. Like if you want to like learn how to produce, like, you know, the keyboard grid format is like it's piano.
Yeah.
And my parents were like, okay, if you want to learn another instrument, you have to at least do, I think it was 1 year of piano. And I wanted to, like most other kids, I wanted to play guitar. Yeah. And I was like, okay, yeah, I'll do a year of piano. And then they bought me like a Costco beginner electric guitar. And like, I learned that for like a while. And so I definitely kept with music for a long time. Like I still like play guitar. I didn't continue with piano. I wish I did. I wish I like actually knew a little bit more of like music theory, and that's definitely something that I keep going back to like expand my knowledge. But
you gravitated towards music like from a young age.
Yeah. I think one of my first memories of like wanting to do music was there was a cartoon that was a Sonic the Hedgehog, but it was Sonic Underground, and it was like a really I think they did one season, and I have a really fond memory of watching this show with my siblings. And like it was like Sonic and two of his siblings, and they all had special abilities, but it was just playing different instruments. And like Sonic played the guitar, and Sonic was my favorite figure, and I was like, I'm gonna do with that. And yeah, so it's definitely been like, as long as I can remember, it's music has been a very, very big constant in my life.
Was there always this interest in creating your own music as well? Or did that kind of come later?
The first time that I ever like made my own music, I think I would write stuff on guitar a little bit, like in high school. Maybe there's a copy of this that exists somewhere, and I really hope there isn't. But when I was a freshman in high school, I recorded a mostly cover CD of like, I played guitar, ukulele, and sang. And I made this for my high school girlfriend for like a Christmas. It was like 15 songs.
15?
It was
That's
so
deep.
It was a lot. There was like some Death Cab for Cutie. There was like Gnarls Barkley. There was like a lot of weird stuff. And then the very last song, I wrote an original song because I was like, This is going to be the one. She's going to love me forever for this one. And Emily, if you still have that CD, I will pay you $100 to send me that or even like burn a copy.
That'd be
or
incredible.
Whatever,
you start putting it out, dropping it on the Tacit Patreon.
No, if you buy the vinyl bundle, the exclusive one, you get a copy of my cover CD with one original.
That's amazing. So were you like using GarageBand or something along those lines to make those recordings?
Audacity.
That Audacity. Was the first software I used to like record my first podcasts.
I mean, it was the freeware goat of its time. The reason I knew how to use Audacity for the most part was my oldest brother Devin used to do like basically what is now Nightcore remixes of like it's just sped up, pitched up songs, and he'd burn CDs and hand them out to all of our friends. We'd call them the chipmunked versions. Most notably, I definitely remember All Star fucking
Smash Mouth. Okay,
that being chipmunked, but. Yeah, he taught me how to like pitch up songs, so I'd be like, okay, cool. And now there's a whole genre that exists of that called Nightcore, and I'm pretty sure my older brother made it.
Pretty creative family overall then.
Yeah. And I definitely think it was, you know, my parents had such a big influence on us, you know, encouraging us to be creative. I know like my mom like said a big reason was that she really didn't get a lot of those experiences growing up, and that she wanted, you know, us to be able to have that. So if we found something that we really enjoyed, that we should stick to it. Like my sister did. My sister has a beautiful voice, and she did like a lot of like voice classes, singing classes, choir stuff like that. My oldest brother had like a guitar, bass, and my closest brother Jesse played drums. So we were like, basically could have formed a family band at some point. Now thinking why we never did that.
So it was always around.
Yeah.
Plenty of inspiration happening around you, and you got older siblings putting you on to stuff.
Yeah, totally.
But not until you started taking those classes that you really started getting interested in like producing your own music.
Yeah. I think that was definitely like a result of I think I wanted to be a DJ before I really wanted to produce, because honestly like the SoundCloud scene starting in like for me like 2011 or something like that, just like starting to dig for really underground like original music, started like, you know, exploring like the beat scene and just like stuff that I'd never heard or that like, you know, really wasn't like popular anywhere else but SoundCloud, made me want to experiment. And I think that's kind of like why I took that first course, is because I was like, oh man, I want to like make this song like this dude Sam Galatry made on like SoundCloud or something. Like Mr. Carmack is like dropping these crazy songs. And I was just like wanted to like even scratch like a little bit the tip of the iceberg with that. And I mean, I started by like wanting to do just like remixes. I was like, that was the coolest thing to me. It was like, oh man, you can take like this popular song and put your own spin on it. And I remember like downloading the first stems to like, I think the first remix that I ever did was the song Faded by Zoo. And there was like a remix competition, and if I dug on one of my old laptops, I could definitely find it, but it's not good.
Do you feel like that was like the equivalent of almost like learning cover songs in that world, and like it taught you a lot just about like structure, even like doing the remixes, or just like really allowed you to like explore what you could do even without creating necessarily like your own original songs?
100%. I mean, that's like doing covers on guitar is how I learned how to play guitar, because I did lessons for piano when I was a young kid, and my parents got me a guitar, and I think I was in a jazz band where I did not learn to read music or anything for like a year before I was like, this is not it for me, this is not my style, I don't really like playing with other people that much, or at least at the time I didn't. And so I would just like sit in front of my computer at ultimateguitar.com and just like learn as many songs in as many tunings as possible, and that like taught me, you know, okay, this is how songs are built. Like, this is like structure. These are like, you know, the chorus, bridge, verses, stuff like that. Doing remixes definitely like taught me how to like listen to songs, like to be able to like actually deconstruct things and be like, oh, these are the different like layers, like sonically. Like shortly after I started like making those remixes, I would sit in my, like, I had this studio room. I lived in a basement when I was 19, 20. And there was a tiny room attached to it that was like maybe like 4 feet by 6 feet and concrete on all sides except for the ceiling. So I could blast music at night. I mean, like, not like anybody cares when you're 20 years old, but I would just blast music, turn all the lights off, close my eyes, and just try to like actually analyze songs and like figure out how certain things sound the way they do, like why they sound the way they do. So yeah, I think like doing the remixes, starting, that's what kind of gave me any sort of like the beginning fundamentals for like writing songs.
Yeah. And I don't know, it always seems like with this style of music, you have to have some level of engineering skills, even if they're, you know, very minimal, because you're often like, the way you have to shape these types of songs, like, I would assume that like learn, like diving into all those remixes, like gave you some understanding of like how things are supposed to actually just sound sonically to make them hit.
Yeah. Yeah. Just like certain artists, like I have to say, like Flume is the person that I spent like so many countless hours like analyzing those kind of structures and being like, okay, I like modeled my, even when I started writing original music,
yeah,
I wasn't writing original music, I was trying to just replicate. Yeah. I was like, and I think that was like such an important period, and I still find myself doing that, like when I want to dive into something new, like was it just like took so long of like trying to replicate my favorite kind of stuff before I like got the idea of like, oh, this is how that you accomplish that kind of thing. Even if it's the more basic things like learning new like drum patterns for like a new genre, like just for the album, like before the album, I had only had a few attempts at doing anything like drum and bass. And the Derealization, which is a VIP of the original song that came out a couple years before that, the when I decided I wanted to put that song on the album, even though it had already been out for a long time, I was like, I want to make this fit in slash stand out at the same time more on the album. I want to like make it more fresh. And so I just took the project and I was like, what could I do with it? And I was super, super inspired by the song Supersonic by Skrillex, Josh Pan, and Noisia. And legitimately, they do, I think Skrillex VIP, or they're all of their VIPs on it. It literally does what I did with Derealization. So I 100% like copied this idea of like, oh, first drop is like this big trap kind of like bassy section, and then drum and bass second like drop. So it was like one of those things where I was like, I'm going to emulate this because I like it so much. And like for the longest time, I had this guilt about like, oh man, like, I'm not even doing anything original, because I'm just like taking parts of what I like in the music that I listen to and like using it for myself. And it took so long before I was like, wait, that's what everybody's doing. Yeah. With every kind of art, like everywhere. Yeah. Pretty much.
Especially early on. I mean, that's just like what you do, you know. Yeah. Your inspiration, like the things that inform your lens, I think like really come through in your early work, because that's all you kind of have. Yeah. You know, and then as you do it longer, you start to kind of like carve out your own voicing for these things where it becomes your sound. But yeah, it's just like anything. I mean, when I started this podcast, there were people that inspired like my style of like how I wanted to go about having conversations. So I think it's just like yeah, you got to give yourself some grace. Like, that's the way, that's the way you do it, you know? And it also doesn't mean that you can't be making something that still hits, even in that period of creative time where you are just like kind of ripping things off, but like, you're still doing the work. It's not like you're, you know, taking things piece for piece.
Totally.
You know?
Yeah. And it's like, I think that example, the derealization one, is the closest I've gotten, like the most, man, I'm really looking at this formula and using it. And for some reason, like, I still can feel this, like, that is 100% authentically me, even though it's like something that I like looked for in another piece of art to like make my own. But I think it was like, can I release this and put my name on it? Like, do I feel like this is something that I've actually injected myself into? And I was like, yeah, because like, it is the sum of my inspiration and my experiences, because like, I'm building off of this song that I made a couple years ago, and I'm reinventing it in a way that it's like true to myself.
Yeah. I think it's like, yeah, it becomes like, you have to think about it as like an homage to these people
totally
who have like paved the way for you and like really created things that have inspired you to make art.
Yeah.
And also, I think like one of the things I love about like the electronic world of music, of like how acceptable it is to almost remix your own songs, and like how open-ended that is.
Totally.
You know, I love that, you know, you can go back to a song that you maybe made a few years back and figure out what its new voicing is, if it's still speaking to you, or if you feel like there was something left unturned or something like that. I love that that electronic music is kind of open in that world, because I think it like maybe feels a little bit different in a singer-songwriter world of like, oh, I'm gonna put this song out again, and it's just this different version. And it, and I think that's like actually like maybe just a weird stigma, because it's stupid. Like, if you have a new, like, I don't know, a new lens for this song,
or like perspective to put on it,
or you feel like it actually delivers like something different,
and
like, why not, you know, if this song still resonates with you? And I think it's also just like a cool way to, you know, keep a song fresh that did mean something to you at a certain point, and maybe it feels completely different to you now, but you still want to share what that is.
Totally. I mean, and it's like, it's the same as sampling another person's like artwork too, but it's more deeply personal, because it's like something that you did yourself and you're coming back to it and, you know, revisiting it. And like, I mean, there's, my album's been out for like 3 months or something now, and luckily at this point I haven't gone back and listened to it like a bunch of times, so I'm not obsessing over things that I would have done differently. But I know down the road there's gonna be those moments where I was like, you know what, I should have done blank, or like, that would have been a perfect time for blank. And that, you know, will always be a possibility to like go back and do that.
Yeah, why not remix your own joint, you know?
It's like, those are definitely royalty free samples.
Yeah, you don't have to worry about that at all.
Yeah. And just like the idea of like changing like the mood on something, and like in that sense, like, oh man, like, not even for your own stuff, but for other people's music, like, one of the most I remember the first time that I heard the Johnny Cash cover of Hurt.
Yeah.
And I hadn't even heard the original. Like I went back after that and I was like, whoa, this came first. And like, I read the story about how like Trent Reznor like heard Johnny Cash's cover, and he was like, that's not our song anymore. That's his song. And I was like, whoa. That's like an amazing thing, because like, you hear that cover and you're like, whoa, he made that his own. Yeah. Like, he truly put his life experience. He didn't change the words. I think the chords could be are a little different, but it's a different song.
The tone is completely different.
The tone is so changed.
It's not like this industrial.
Yeah.
It's all of a sudden, it's this very sad, folk country song.
Oh man, that still gives me chills, like going back and listening to that.
And just like the age that Johnny Cash was when he made that song. That was so late in the game for him.
Yeah.
I remember like when that video came out. It was still like a time where music videos came out.
Yeah.
I feel like regularly on MTV or things like that.
And it probably wouldn't have been for, if not for Rick Rubin, that stuff would have came through. Because he was like the one who came back when Johnny Cash thought he was like done. And, like,
yeah.
Reinvented himself at the very end of his life.
Yeah, it's kind of the beautiful thing of like someone else's take on a song. Like,
yeah,
like you didn't even know about the Nine Inch Nails version, or like there's gonna be some people who didn't really like go into that genre of music, and all of a sudden, you know, someone that is playing a genre of music that they enjoy puts out a version of it, and then they find out about the original version because of it. And yeah, it's kind of this beautiful thing.
Yeah.
Especially when someone nails it like that.
Totally.
You know?
And I think it's definitely very special. I think electronic music specifically for having the remix culture for, like, I've found, you know, probably nearly half of the artists that I listen to through, you know, them remixing someone that I like or someone that I like remixing their stuff.
Same.
And it's just like, that's a really, really cool way to, like, build a community, because it's like mostly, you know, you're sharing resources for your art, which is like, I feel like it usually happens like a song gets some sort of success and it was like, okay, let's get other people's take on this, which does capitalize on the attention of the original song, but it also like spreads out the, you know, exposure that other people are like can receive from the success of that song, and gives other people an opportunity to like speak their lens on it, to put their perspective on it.
Yeah, it feels so collaborative too, and it's like not something that was like built in collaboration, you know. It's like this one person made this thing
totally,
and then someone else jumped on it, you know, and gave their take on it, or you know, I love to just go through something where, you know, someone puts out a single and there's five other versions of it.
Yeah.
And maybe one of those versions is just another remix that they did of the track, and then maybe three other artists, like you're saying, like that's how I've found so many artists, is just because like, oh well, I really like this track and these three artists did a version of it, and now I'm following those three artists because of that. Or the artist that made the version that speaks to me most, I'm following that person now.
Totally. And like the craziest thing is like when you love a song so much and then you find someone that remixed it and you're like, oh my God, they made it better.
Yeah.
Or like, oh my God. I remember probably my two of my biggest inspirations that I still obsess over to this day are Daft Punk and Gorillaz. And I remember like just pirating the entire Gorillaz discography, which is huge. Like, honestly, like, even before they started doing a ton of new stuff in, like, 2016 or whenever, like, they really made, you know, Damon Albarn really made his comeback, they had all of, like, the D-sides and G-sides, the remixes of, like, Demon Days and their Gorillaz, the original album, which were, like, 30 different relatively unknown to underground like DJs, producers remixing their stuff. I found Soul Wax's remix of, I think it's Dare, and I was like, that was Gorillaz was probably a little bit before I really like got on to like Daft Punk, and so like dance music wasn't super known to me. Like, I didn't like know anything about like house music or anything, and then hearing like, obviously Gorillaz are very dance influenced in certain tracks more than others, but hearing like a real dance take on one song that I had been listening to on repeat for like months and months, I was like, how do you do this? What is this? What does Soul Wax remix mean? Does that mean, does that just like, is that someone who was involved making the song doing it, or is that like just Damon Albarn being like, here's 30 other versions of that? Like, I legitimately had no idea what artists remixing other things meant at that time. And that just opened up the entire, like, that is how I found so many people that, like, I think, like, Pretty Lights was the first electronic concert that I actually ever went to, and that was only because I found someone's remix of his song or his remix of some other song, and I don't know, that just like opened up the entire world of like electronic music when I was not I was not trying to like get into that.
Yeah, it just happened. Opened you up to it.
Yeah.
Speaking to what you were talking about earlier, as far as maybe, you know, going back and listening yourself to the It Comes in Waves record, and, you know, there's already maybe some things that you hear in there that you would want to change now. Is the live show an opportunity to do those types of things? Like, is there room or like space for some improvising or like keeping things a little open-ended when you're performing these songs live, that you can explore maybe some of those things that you didn't do on the recorded versions? Or is it like something that you try to keep the structure in place?
I think it absolutely can be pretty open-ended. I've already, I don't know how many times I'm going to like keep doing specifically like It Comes in Waves as a live show, but I know that especially for certain songs off there, like those are going to be songs that I take through for years because like they're so near and dear to my heart. But I know like already there's a couple songs that I feel like I want to be able to keep this with me, even if the next phase sounds a lot different. And for those things, like, I've kind of already started imagining either like, luckily with the format of the live show, it's a lot of like stems and like cueing different, either like the vocals with these synths, blah, 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 like different parts of the songs. I've already experimented a lot with like mashing up different songs together, and I've found some really crazy stuff. Luckily, I guess I tend to write a lot of my music in complementary keys, which I did not do on purpose, but works out really well in my favor. Or like, you know, pitch shifting just a little bit and it makes stuff work. But that is one thing that I've also taken so much inspiration from the electronic acts that I've seen, like, that do live shows, as opposed to most DJ sets. Sometimes you get some really, really cool alternate versions with DJ sets. But to talk about Flume once again, I've seen him like 5 times now. I just got to see him at Red Rocks. It's my first time going to Red Rocks in September, which was so cool. But I've been, like, I remember the very, very first time that someone showed me a Flume song, which was in my junior year of high school. And like, I got super obsessed with him, and he still plays like the very, very first song that, you know, some kid who's sitting behind me put his Beats over my ears, and he's playing the Hyper Paradise remix. And he still plays it in songs to this day, but he will do it in so many different ways, like reinvent it. Like, he's done some like cool, like break drum and bass remixes. He's done like some, like, you know, mashing up the instrumental of a super popular song with like maybe one of his old like sleepers from his catalog or something like that. And so that's like, I think one of the coolest things that you can use as a tool in performing is like nostalgia and familiarity. And I think that's one of the things that like I definitely want to like keep around, because like getting people emotionally involved in a show is the way that you can experience like so much of their energy.
Yeah.
It's like people, when you like trigger people's emotions, they get so much more, you know, invested in a show. And if you can do that by like reminding them of an old feeling that they had when they used to listen to that song, then like they're going to remember that.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, it's a powerful thing to like be able to tap into something like that. As far as making the It Comes in Waves record, the first full-length Tacit record, also one of my favorite things that has come out of the city this year.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's just seriously, so good. Like, you. I love just cruising. It's so fun to just, like, drive around and listen to. you know, or like even today I was just kind of listening in headphones and laying on the ground, and it's just like I came to electronic music, I feel like, later in my life, and instrumental music or things that lean more instrumental in general a little bit later, but it's just become one of my favorite things to listen to. And I think it's just the open-endedness for my imagination while mm-hmm. I'm listening to those things.
Yeah.
It just feels like there's, you know, there's never a narrative to really like tell you what you're supposed to be feeling often when you're totally. Listening to instrumental music. So, yeah, talk to me about just like making this full length record. And also, like, what is, I know that there's some moments where there's some vocal features, but mm-hmm. yeah, what do you like about instrumental music and making instrumental music?
I think you just touched on something that's like one of my favorite things about listening to music and electronic music, maybe not specifically, but it's like you can, when there's no narrative that's directly explicit, like with, you know, singer-songwriter music, which feels like really focal point on one person's story, you can like the narrative-less music, you can put yourself as the main character, or it can be like just you, this is your soundtrack. And that's kind of something that I really, really wanted to capture, is like, you know, being able to carve out a little section of not necessarily like my life directly, but the like the emotions and some of the experiences that I've had during the period like around making this album and before it. I really had some of the biggest like ups and downs in my life, like was facing like a like lot of depression and anxiety. I moved to Portland like 6 months before the pandemic happened and didn't have like a ton of friends, and so I was mostly just making music in a basement for a while. And I really like struggled to like kind of find comfort in the process of even making music for a while, which is like I had already kind of like told myself, I was like, this is what I want to do, but now I'm kind of like lost. And the first the intro to the album, actually, which was one of the first things that came to life from it, was my friend Elijah does like video graphics, like motion graphics and stuff like that, and he was just like experimenting a ton with like Blender at the time, and he was like, hey, would you want to like make some, not even music, but just like noise stuff for this? And I was like, yeah, I'd like love to do that. I've been in creative funk lately. I haven't been able to make shit that I like. And so I just like, it was just like this very abstract video with like these waves that come in and out and this object kind of like forming. And I like made like just this sound design, synth swells, the stuff that, you know, came to be.
Yeah. This is like before you had any intention of like making a record, like a
I had
record.
No idea that I was making an album at the point. And it's funny that the like wave stuff came and happened, because I was like, I had no idea that it was going to be like named that. And I made that sound, and then I sent it back, and he like, you know, posted on Instagram. And it wasn't until like a couple months later that I was still in this funk, and I was like, man, like, how can I get out of this? And I was like, what if I just write on something that I've already like started, like we were talking about, like putting a new perspective. And I came back to the, just like this 30-second little sound design thing. And I was like, what if that's the start to a song, or the start to a whole project or something like that? And so there's like that big, like kind of like silence and Foley sounds of waves. And that's stuff that I actually recorded on a trip to Hawaii, like a few years ago. And I didn't put that sound in until a little bit later, but I kind of like just started that as the intro. And I remember when I wrote the little lead, the boom, 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 I was sitting at my little synth in my basement little studio, just feeling a lot of nothing for a really long time. And I stumbled on that sound through just, you know, a patch, and I tweaked it a bunch, and I played those notes in a row, and I legitimately started sobbing, crying, and just feeling like this heaviness, but it's starting to like lift. And I was like, I didn't record it for like an hour. I just kept playing the notes over and over again and just fucking crying. And I was like, I don't know what this means, but I think it's a good sign. And that was just like, that was the beginning. And I didn't even quite realize that it was like album at that point.
Yeah.
I don't think it was until that I went on this trip to Hawaii, which was like maybe I think like a year later or something like that. And I had kind of wrote a couple more songs. I think I wrote Petrichor and Synapse, which are two very, very, very different songs. And I was on this trip in Hawaii, and I kind of like was, sorry, mom and dad, I was tripping on acid on a beach in Hawaii, and thinking about like kind of what I wanted to do with this, like, you know, entire music project. And I've been like, I've been working at this for so long, and I don't put out very much music. Like, I would make so much music, and probably 99% of it would get scrapped or just be on, you know, it's hard drive dust. And I finally like decided at some point, I think it was on this trip, and I was like, okay, you know what, I've been making enough stuff that I can focus my energy into an album. I think I'm ready to do this. And so I was like standing on the beach, and I was quite literally just watching these waves roll in, high on acid, and my friend Elijah behind me is talking to his girlfriend, now fiance, about how the experience is feeling. And he just says the words, "It comes in waves." And that just echoes through my head as I'm like watching this beautiful Hawaii beach coming in, and the feeling of like the ocean breeze and everything. And I just turn around and I'm like, "You did it." He was like, "What?" I was like, "You named my album." And it was like, okay. So like I had brought my my field recorder, and I just started taking tons of like Foley sounds, and I was like, it needs to be this beach right here, and all this stuff. So that's kind of like how it started. And you know, I went back home, and I definitely was like charged up. Like, I had felt that I kind of got some direction in where I wanted to go, and kind of started just seeing what would come out, creating with having this album in mind a little bit, but not wanting to be like, okay, what is the structure? What is the narrative?
Yeah.
Cause I didn't want to like be so explicit that I couldn't let moments speak for themselves. Which is like one of the things that I really wanted to do. Like, I wanted it to be a very present album.
You didn't want to force it.
Exactly. I wanted it to like speak my experience without like, I guess it comes back to exactly why I named my project Tacit. Is for a few years when I started producing, I was just going by my last name. I was going by Bowman because I was like, I don't want to pick a name that I am going to regret. I think finally I just like ran. There was a song that was stuck in my head. I think it was by this artist. It's called Gemini Feed by Banks, and it says something. I had like lyrics stuck in my mind. I think it says like something about your tacit affection. And I was like, that sounds really cool. I have no idea what the word tacit means. And so I looked it up, and it said implied or understood without being directly expressed. And I was like, that's what I want to do.
It's perfect.
That's what I want to do with music. And it's a cool sounding word.
Yeah.
And so like, that's like, what I kind of, it's like almost like a mission statement with the project is like, I want to really be able to make songs that like, you know, transcend an explicit narrative, but you're still able to like get the understand the emotion / you know, like at the same time project your own experiences into. And luckily, like, based on the feedback that I've gotten, like, it sounds like I've been able to, like, I did that. And it feels fucking really cool.
That's very cool, Zach, because I feel like I feel like asking people what their artist name came from or means is like very hacky, and it usually doesn't have a great story. So I'm glad that right. you just like we got there and you were able to share that, because I do think that that's like it does feel like a cool mission statement almost for right. what you're doing. And I don't know, do you feel like maybe we can go as specific as making this particular record, but do you feel like it's almost more like while you were making these songs that you were just, you know, you spoke about feeling those emotions and just being brought to tears with that, you know, that first track maybe
yeah.
that you were making. Do you feel like it's more just feeling your emotions while you're creating this music versus even like expressing what you're feeling? Does that even make sense?
I think I know exactly what you're saying. This is so weird. I've been doing this like morning journaling. That's a part of my fiance got me the book The Artist Way.
Yeah,
cool. You know what, you know, I know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, it's the morning pages, right?
Yeah,
people
yeah.
have talked about it. I've never done it myself. It seems like it would be something that would be very serving to my psyche. I have not got into it myself, but some other people that have been on the podcast over the years have brought up what
totally.
These morning pages are.
I've never been able to like journal consistently at all. But I've been doing this. It's like 3 pages every morning or something like that. And this morning, lately, like in the last couple weeks, I've had like nothing really on the mind. I guess for anybody listening, the morning pages are like a part of the artist way is just 2 staples. One is like going on an artist date, taking yourself out and doing something that might inspire some sort of creativity, no matter what it is, like going to see a movie, going on a walk, doing anything
solo.
Yeah, solo, not to be shared with anybody else. Same with the morning pages, like stuff that is supposed to be deeply personal. You get up, one of the first things you do in the morning is just write 3 pages, no matter what it is. If it's just literally word vomit, literally just saying I don't want to do this. So like in the last couple of weeks, I haven't had what feels like these things like really dying to get on the page, so I'll just write affirmations, like just different things about like, you know, manifesting, whatever, blah, blah, blah. The last couple of days, I've actually like been just thinking on the page. And today specifically, I was kind of thinking about like what I'm trying to accomplish in more literal words. And I think that like today I kind of stumbled upon something. I was like, well, all I can honestly do is be as vulnerable emotionally and like be true with the music that I'm making and the way that, you know, I express myself, which is not really supposed to be literal. It's like very just emotional, because I have absolutely no control in how people will receive it. And I think I want to give up control of like trying to tell a narrative or like whatever, because my job ends as soon as the music is done. And that's like, I'm not going to ever show somebody a song and be like, this is a really sad piece. Like this is something that's like about heartbreak or blah, blah, blah. I will never do that with my music. So in the end, I just want to be as vulnerable as possible. And whatever comes out of that, you know, is like going to be the product.
Yeah. Well, you're doing it. It's working. It's working.
Thank you.
It hit heavy, the whole record. And yeah, you got that interlude track on the record.
Yeah.
You know, I was curious what you feel like the importance of, and it doesn't have to be that particular one, but like the importance of interlude tracks within a record and like how that can like shape the listening experience.
Totally. I think there's like a really, I mean, there's some gorgeous interludes in a lot of my favorite albums. Some of my favorite ones, like Alt-J's first album, those interludes feel like they're kind of those are highly metaphorical kind of narratives, like those their albums specifically. And the interludes for that are kind of like breaks slash what kind of feel like world building, if you know what I mean, like in an atmospheric way.
Yeah.
They kind of like build on the feelings that are being more or less expressed in the songs around them, and kind of just like breaks from the direct narrative, but still in that realm. What I tried to do, I had a previous interlude actually that was going to be a whole song, and then I couldn't finish the song, and so I like kind of tore out a lot of the structure and just built like a more ambient-ish piece. And I was like, okay, this is fine, but it's like it kind of lost. I like kept taking out a bunch of the parts, and then it just had no meaning. It sounded like a pretty piece of music, but it just like this doesn't feel like it has any of the emotion that I started with. And that's what I liked about it on the place that it had on my album before I decided to get rid of it. And then I had this hole that was like right between, I had kind of decided on a bit of the structure of the album as far as like the song placement. But, and what I realized at that point was there was going to be a softer, more uplifting beginning to the album, and then the end was going to be a lot more in your face, a lot more higher energy, and like a little bit darker too.
Yeah.
But I had like this gap from, I think, the song Breathe with Amethyst to I think it's Pulse, which comes right after the interlude. And it was like this, I tried to like order it in different ways where I was like, okay, this doesn't work. And finally I was like, okay, I used to have an interlude here, and that's why it made sense. And so I sat down and I started trying to like just write something on the keyboard, and I stumbled on this melody that I had written like 7 years ago, on when I was going by my old name Bowman, and it was this song literally called New Tides. And it was a song that I wrote after I got dumped. And I was like, it was just like this big, emotional, heavy electronic piece. But it had this melody that I like had. I'm just now kind of realizing I had the exact same experience when I wrote the intro to this, what I was talking about, just crying at the keyboard. I had that when I wrote the melody for this song 7 years ago. Wow, that's crazy. I just absolutely just re-experienced a memory. So I like stumbled on that melody, which, you know, I hadn't played my old song in 5 years or something like that. And I experienced those emotions again. And I was like, whoa, that's taking me back. And I was like, is it wrong to reuse this? And this gets back into the conversation that we were having. I was like, no, I wrote that. Like, that was me like 7 years ago. And so I kind of just like started writing all these like little pieces around it. And I like kind of, this was probably a month and a half before the album came out too. And I had put a hard, like I had a date and I was like, it's got to be done by then. I kept putting it off for so long. And then I went through and I got rid of the interlude. And then I finally came to that. And I was like, this translates. I feel like all of the gaps on the album and kind of ties stuff in for me emotionally into what this open-ended narrative felt like. So it definitely, I don't know, it kind of was like a full circle thing to do, you know, to sample myself or, you know, use my own melody to tie in things from elsewhere into the album.
Yeah, it's rad. It's it's a moment I really love on the record, and I think it speaks to like what you were talking about. It's just those are the moments where I feel like you can really you know, hammer away at the world building with those types of tracks. And it's also cool to just, you know, there's kind of this raw, stripped down piano feel to it at certain moments, and it's kind of cool to, obviously that's where your foundation of learning that piano like totally. Kicks in, and you get to flex those skills a little bit, even if you feel like your understanding is of the instrument is not like as wide as you would like it to be. You can totally. Tell that you can use it as a songwriting tool and use it to shape songs still.
Thank
for
you,
sure
for one. But yeah, I think that's where like the majority of my, I mean, I can't even say majority, all of my songs start with playing keys or randomly like a sample that inspires me. But
yeah.
Even if it's that, then it's playing keys on top of that sample.
Yeah.
And so it's like, that is the heart and soul of like where my music starts. It's just like, and because I don't have this anything more than fundamental skill or knowledge of music theory, like it is, it's very, very beginner level. It does feel sometimes like it is just luck. That is like, oh my God, I stumbled upon that. Like, I don't know what these chord formations are.
Yeah.
And like, you know, part of my mantra that I like, pretty sure I was like 19 when I started like making music was, I'm the luckiest person that I've ever met. That's why the last song on the album is also named Lucky, is because it had like four different names. And I'm like, it doesn't express it. It was a song that I felt like I got lucky because I had just got the Korg Minilog synth, and I literally just found these chords and I just looped it, and I like had this synth loop that I did nothing with for months.
Yeah.
And I just, like I did with the intro of my album, I was in another funk. I came back to it, tried to make it into like a vibey deep house track. It didn't work. And then I like threw everything away but that synth loop, sped it up a little bit, and then I found its proper place, and I was like, I'm lucky. I just like lucky to just, I think, to name drop him again, Rick Rubin talks about a lot of being an artist is just being an antenna, I think, or like being, you know, being open to the signals. And I'm like, I was raised Christian. Went through a period of being like very anti-religious, very anti-spiritual. I'm like a very spiritual person, very, you know, non-denominational, where I just like, I absolutely believe in a energy that is undeniable, that like is very creative, that like, you know, is the force of the world, is the good thing that connects all people to like all living beings. And these moments on this album, especially like the intro and like Lucky and the interlude, were times that I felt like I was in the right place listening to the moment at the right time. My friend Chris one time said this really abstract thought to me, and I had no idea. He just said he came up with it. He studied philosophy, I think, and he would oftentimes just talk to me about like very random thoughts that he had. But he said something like, act is as if moments can hear what you're thinking. And I was like, that's really, really weird. How much did you take, dude? But I just like started thinking about it a lot, and then kind of like, I guess the reverse of it is just like trying to be able to understand what moments are thinking, and I think that is the feeling of being able to catch like a signal from the universe, or just being an open
to it.
Yeah. And I think that's, yeah, that's what this music project, and that's, I'm sure, like, so many people can dedicate a lot of their creative work to just being ready and being open in the right moments.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do think it's, I think people that don't have any knowledge of music theory or have never had any, like, intense lessons maybe on certain instruments or things like that, I think those people are, like, often the ones that kind of, you know, that signal is open in a different way, because you don't have this thing kind of nagging at you that this is the proper way to do this, you know, like, you don't have this, like, all of this knowledge to kind of shake. And it's kind of, you know, it's similar to, you know, as you get older, you're almost like trying to unlearn all these things that were, like, put upon you,
right,
as a kid. And, like, when you don't have that background of having that music theory, you don't have anything to unlearn. You can just kind of go with what feels right for what you're creating.
Yeah,
which is really nice, I feel like.
Yeah, I definitely kind of find myself, like, missing a lot of the times when I had so many less ideas of what you should and should not do with music.
Yeah.
And also even the tools that I have, like, some of my most creatively aspirational ideas came at a time when I was using, like, an 8-year-old laptop and a failing, breaking a key every new week kind of keyboard where I would, like, literally have to skip notes when I was recording stuff and write them in MIDI later. Like, sometimes I would just, like, have, I would feel like, oh man, I have the next 20 steps right here, because, like, I had no constraints and no, like, previous ideas that were informing the next step that, yeah, I should make. So it was just being this extremely, it was like this sense of presence within creativity that led so many of my ideas. And it's like, now, you know, it feels like sometimes, like, pulling teeth to, like, just get an idea. And especially, like, you know, lately I'm, like, post album, I've written a few things that I'm, like, very excited to release, but, like, I lately have been sitting down and just, like, man, I got nothing. And that's kind of why I'm doing, like, this, the artist way, yeah, thing, and especially, like, why I'm trying to be super open to it, is because it is a lot about, like, you know, working your brain to be more of, like, beginner's mind, and that kind of whole philosophy of just, like, coming at things without this informed, like, idea, just, like, being very present with the moment. And that's something that's really hard to do, like, all the time.
Absolutely. Yeah, because then you start thinking about, like, how can I be present? Yeah. You're, it's like, you're fucking it up. That's not how you do
you
it.
Are,
you're already
step,
not
no,
being present.
You messed up. Yeah. No, it's so, it's like an absolute conundrum. And I think it's, like, something that every artist probably struggles with, yeah, for the entirety of your career.
Absolutely.
But it's, like, also a part of the beauty of it is just, like, there will be those times where when you are present and prepared,
mm-hmm,
the moment will speak to you.
So when you're experiencing, like, maybe a funk, a creative funk, will you force yourself to sit down and try to make music to fight through it and see what that yields? Or do you try to just step away from it?
I think sometimes both. I think the more that I do it, I learn that I, like, shouldn't force it. And if I am going to force it, that it's okay to, like, just think of it as, like, practicing guitar or something like that. Just, like, you know, flexing the muscles, just practicing sound design. But I think more often it's becoming clear that it's really good to step away. And, like, I don't think I could have finished an album if there weren't, like, few month breaks in between certain songs where, like, I used to, I think at the beginning of 2021, I tried, I was like, I'm going to do I'm going to make a new beat every single day for the entire year. And I think I got through February and I was like, this sucks. I am starting to hate sitting at my desk making these. I'd like put a timer and be like, whatever it sounds like at the end of 45 minutes, that's it.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, wait, I think this is not good for me actually. And it's like definitely like it taught me a few things about like efficiency. A few different, you know, cool ideas came out of it, but mostly like I definitely was trying to force creativity, and that was giving me this like negative reinforcement that it's like something that I should be able to summon.
Yeah.
And it's it just doesn't like work like that.
Or it's something that like felt cool for like the first couple times that you did it.
Yes.
And then it's like, this isn't really fresh anymore. Like,
yeah,
this
totally.
Isn't doing the thing that it did the first couple times.
Yeah. And it's like, I know that, you know, I have the ability to write music. And so it was like something that I think I was trying to prove to myself at the time was like, can I be... is this something that I can realistically sit down and do every single day?
Yeah.
And the answer is no.
Well, it's tough. It's tough when you find, when you do find something in a certain way too. And then you're maybe trying to tap back into that to
yeah.
create the next thing.
Right? Oh man. Yeah. Yeah. I think, just like trying to like, yeah, force creativity doesn't work. And also just like trying to prove to yourself like, okay, well, I did it this one time, so that means I can do it again,
yeah.
is also, like, a fallacy that you have to, like, get out of. Because, like, yeah, you can make the same exact thing time and time again, but, like, if it isn't, like, like authentic creativity, then, like, unless you're just using it as a source of practice, like, it's so easy to get frustrated and want to, like, give up when you aren't, like, constantly, like, hitting gold every
yeah.
time you like make something, if that's your expectation. So I guess like one of the biggest things too would be what I'm trying to do now, even if I'm like in a funk, like right now I'm not writing that much stuff, just really trying to lower the expectations of anything, of even like having a solid practice, of even finding a good sample or designing a good patch or something like that. Just lowering the expectations and thinking about like how much fun it was when I was 19 to just have a piece of hardware and Ableton in front of me, and how much fun it was just to be like, what does that do? Just to be able to like absolutely drop all expectations and yeah, beginner's mind, I guess, is what I'm trying to say again.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's also that thing of like reminding yourself of this is supposed to be fun.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Not that it shouldn't be like work at times and like challenge you to get to the next level of things or challenge you to explore outside of your creative comfort zone. But, you know, like this is supposed to be fun. It's not
yeah.
supposed to be super like for myself, you know, like I love getting to sit down and have these conversations. But, you know, there's a lot of stress that goes into like preparing for it sometimes or getting everything set up. And like, it's so important to like, yeah, I'm so excited that I get to have someone like yourself come and just sit down and like bullshit about art or
yeah.
the creative process, or just get to talk with somebody. And it's just like, yeah, it's supposed to be a fun thing. It's not
totally.
Supposed to be something that like drives you mad.
Yeah. I guess that really does like give a good point to like both sides of the coin. Like what we want to, the best part is like, you know, the fun part, but it doesn't exist without showing up.
Yeah.
And I think like that's one of the biggest things too, is like just knowing that some of the struggle, some of the nitty gritty work, like, you know, for me a lot, it's like doing the mixing and mastering and that kind of stuff, or like sitting down when the ideas don't happen.
Yeah.
Like you have to at least show up for any of it to go wrong or to go right. And if you don't, then you don't get to enjoy the fruits, the fun parts, like having this conversation or like striking that gold and being like, this is what I've been working for. And yeah, I think that's like, I guess like it's supposed to be everything. Like obviously like why we do it is the fun part, but it's also like it's supposed to be difficult at times, and it's like it's supposed to be a chore at other times when it's like the really boring. Like, I'm sure like editing this is probably like a good amount of work.
Yeah, it's often can feel like the burden.
Yeah,
until I get into it.
Yeah,
and then I get to see it come together, and that's beautiful, and that gets me excited.
Yeah,
you know, it's like it's like going to the gym. You know, it's like the idea of going to the gym feels like awful.
Yeah,
and then 5 minutes in to, you know, working out, I feel great about it. And I'm just like, oh, I'm so happy I'm
endorphins
here.
Endorphins pumping.
And it's just like, as soon as I'm 15 minutes into editing the video and get to see it all and like get to kind of relive maybe some of the moments in the conversation, I'm like, oh, this is so beautiful. I'm so glad that I'm so lucky again, like what you were talking about. I'm so lucky that I get to do this. I'm so lucky that I got to have this conversation. And then I feel so grateful that I'm putting together this thing.
Totally.
So art, man.
Yeah. I'm really, really grateful that, like, for one, I've like stuck with it. Like, it's been, you know, I think there's one point in my life, like 4 years after I started making music, where I was really like undiagnosed depressed and anxious, and when I was just like really living unhealthily and just not treating myself well, where I was still like trying to make music and I was like driving myself crazy, and I was like literally, you know, I'm still a very, very small artist, but this time I was like, there were like, you know, 10 friends listening to my music, and it was a really big deal to me though, and I was like, made an Instagram post that I was like, I have to take a break. I've been driving myself crazy doing all this stuff. And it was like this really dramatic thing, even though like I literally was making music for myself at that point, where I was like, man, maybe I have to quit. Maybe I'm not built for this. And it was just like so silly to imagine that like there was a point in my time where I was letting my, like, a lot of my depression come from not being able to, like, create stuff, to be able to make art. 'Cause that's, like, the opposite of the point of, like, any of this is to, like, like, there's the whole idea that, like, you know, great art is made from suffering. I think that's, like, definitely bullshit for a lot of it. Suffering can make good art, but I think just experiences make good art in general. Positive, negative, whatever.
Mid.
There's so many. I bet there's tons of art made from mid experiences.
Mid experiences is like either a great album name or like artist name.
Mid experiences sounds like a good lo-fi side project.
Amazing. Right on. Well, you're now making music for me, Zach.
Cool.
I'm a fan.
I appreciate
of what
that.
You're doing, and like I said, I love this record that you put out, and this has been just, you know, this is the first time we've ever met, and I feel like this has been a great way to get to know you, so I appreciate you taking the time to jump on the mics with me and just talk to me about your process and where all this music is coming from, and definitely like frames things differently for me, and I'll think about these things when I'm listening to It Comes in Waves.
Totally.
You know, next time I'm listening through, I'll have some different framing for it. So I appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah. I mean, thank you so much for having me on. This is definitely the first time that I've like actually been able to like talk about my music in a way that like I'm sharing it with other people. And it's kind of cool to like, you know, although I'll explicitly say Tacit, you know, the name, the reason behind it, I don't want to give people like the mode for listening to my music, but it is so cool to be able to like share some of the process like behind it, and I really appreciate you for taking the time out of your day to do this.
Absolutely. I'll put all the links in the episode notes so people can keep up with what you're doing and check out this record. for sure. Zach, we end every episode of the podcast with the guest saying the tagline for the show, which is, it's a program, and it means absolutely nothing. It's just the way that my grandfather says the word program. He always says program.
Program?
No, yeah, for some reason.
Okay, I like
it's
it.
This weird pronunciation of this word, and I don't know why he does it. One day I'm going to have a deep conversation about it. And you can deliver it however you want. You can deliver this it's a program however you like. It's the one time I will ask you to look directly into that camera and give us the tacit, it's a program, we can properly sail this thing out.
Cool. Well, you've been watching Dan Cable Presents. It's a program.
He nailed it, everybody.
Thank you.
Zach nailed it. Tacit, check out the record. Links will be in the episode notes. And we're going to play the episode out with one of my favorite tracks on the record. It's... Petrichor, is that
cool.
the right pronunciation of that word?
Yep.
We're going to play it out with Petrichor. It's on It Comes in Waves record that we have been talking about throughout this episode. Great record. Check it out. Links are in the episode notes. And that is the Jelly Jams. And we will catch you on the flip side, Portland, or wherever you are listening from.
Thank you.
We did it.
Cool.
Hell yeah.
That was super fun.
That was really fun.
You got a good way of making me talk. I'm like, I was honestly like...